I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about why we eat the way we do. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. So many choices. What a confusing food system we all have. Do you ever feel guilty about your food choices because you read or hear stories about buying at farmers markets? The farm-to-table movement, animal cruelty on big corporate farms, cheap buying at box stores. Or are you too busy to think about any of this? We're going to relieve you of all that and talk with Explore Together, a highly respected chef, Dan Barber, about our nation's food system as it might be. We're a major part of the system. They can offer us choices all day long, but if we make decisions based on how we want it to go, and I mean by we, I mean eaters, growers, meaning farmers, believe me, the so-called system will pay attention. So how do we want food buying and eating to work? Chef Dan Barber has spent many years thinking about this, and he does so eloquently in his book. It's thoroughly researched, The Third Plate, and it is one of the best books about food, possibly the best I have ever read. It's an extraordinary plan for keeping ourselves connected to real food, letting nature take the lead. Is it realistic? As you're going to hear, these are the questions that are going to, is it realistic, given the power of the food industry, to make certain kinds of changes? What could our food buying be like if we did it the right way? And what is that right way? Dan Barber says the farm-to-table movement is great. He has been a practitioner for a long time. But he says farm-to-table doesn't go far enough. So let's explore this together. We're going to give you one man's provocative, enlightening vision about how we could make food buying and eating choices. Chef Dan Barber presides at the highly regarded Blue Hill at Stone Barns in Westchester County and at Blue Hill in Manhattan. His book, described as Field Notes on the Future of Food, is called The Third Plate. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm really grateful and honored to be here.
Me too, back to you. I have to say, this gives me a chance to thank you because I ate at Stone Barns. And I just couldn't believe the experience that I had there. It was just phenomenal. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Okay, so I love this part in the book where you say that you were confronted with questions about all this. I know it happened in trickle by trickle, but in a big way when this food magazine says to a bunch of chefs and editors and artists, imagine what we're all going to be eating in 35 years. And so you were supposed to sketch a plate, just one plate of food, and have that plate show what the future is going to be. Tell me what happened.
Well, the outcome was you know, sort of surprisingly for me anyway, pessimistic from a lot of the people who engaged in this exercise, and I almost went down that road. I mean, there were chefs who created plates with you know, like insects, because they were saying that's the only thing that's going to be left in the next generation, and you know, there were just some really depressing predictions for our table. And I looked at it sort of a little bit more hopefully, not that I'm Pollyannish about really anything, and I've never been called anything but a cynic when it comes to this kind of stuff, but it came to me like during the research of this book, and like I discovered that there really is a possibility to eat in a way that not only reflects the landscape but also improves it. That's a very powerful idea when it comes to food. You know, we tend to think about our diets and how to construct our dinners around, you know, doing less bad and still preserving great flavor and nutrition and feeding our families and our friends in ways that are pleasurable and joyful. And, like, you know, what I started to discover very, very quickly, but you know, much more impressively, just sort of continuously. I mean, it was sort of this that's very fluid and predictable outcome. And everywhere I looked, and this is, I traveled around the world for the research of this book, and traveled a lot in the United States, and also on our own farm at Stone Barns, and then my own farm at Blue Hill Farm. And I came to the sort of same conclusion on all of the examples that I was looking at, which is that it is very possible to eat in accordance with nature, which is to say,
yeah, what do you mean?
Yeah. Well, here's my plate ended up, you know, for this quest to answer this question of what we'll be eating in 35 or 50 years. My plate ended up being a steak, but it wasn't a steak made out of meat. It was a steak made out of parsnips. And it's actually on the menu. It's funny, we're speaking now. It's on the menu tonight because we've just pulled the parsnips from the field last week as the soil was a little less frozen, and we got in there, and so we planted those. Jack Algeo, the head farmer for Somers, planted these parsnips a year ago. So on the menu, we're calling them soil aged for 12 months because normally farmers remove the parsnips in October before the deep freezes. So this kept through the winter, through all the freezes. It's extraordinarily large and extraordinarily sweet. Parsnip, and
yeah.
So we're roasting it like a steak and serving it, you know, you bring it to table on a cart and carving it tableside and serving it with a classic cream spinach and marrow and a rich bordelaise sauce made from meat. So it's not a vegetarian plate, but it's actually served with a little condiment, marmalade of oxtail, of beef tail that's very rich and full of umami and really delicious. And so... But the architecture of the plate has changed dramatically because at this time of year, anyway, where we are in Lhasa Valley, it's quite a lot to ask the land to produce the kind of diet that the typical the ideal or the expectation that Americans have for a plate of food, which is a 7 or 8 ounce piece of protein centering the plate, and generally, and that's a steak, that's a center cut, a sirloin or whatnot, and that's something that our landscape can't provide. I don't think there's any landscape that can really provide it consistently. And so the trick or the happy outcome of this exercise for me anyway was to throw that architecture that on its head and to take dinner on its head and get the pleasure and the flavor that you would get from the experience of eating meat, but do it in a way that reflects what the landscape can provide. And at this time of year, that means heavy on root vegetables and more tinkering, more creativity at the stove with meat to give you an exceptionally delicious plate of food that I think is the true definition of sustainability, because it listens to what the landscape is telling you it can produce.
So you flipped it around. Instead of protein being the biggest thing on the plate, in this case, the root vegetable ends up being the steak, and the meat is a sauce on top of that root vegetable.
Yeah.
And in the end, Dan, I mean, I've had your food, which is at times so unusual and a revelation in terms of how delicious these things can be. You're welcome. But in the end, you know, was that or is that parsnip steak with this meat sauce delicious? Or is it, well, this is what nature is giving to us?
I have no interest in preparing food where you would get up from the table and say, you know, for a meal that did justice to what nature can provide, it was okay, it was pretty good. No. It absolutely has to be delicious and memorable. And by the way, you know, the thing about it is that when we do recognize what farmers really should be growing and support that, and that, you know, it's difficult to do, and that's sort of another subject, but it's that understanding and supporting, the kind of wisdom that goes with buying a lot of parsnips at a certain time of year and less meat or utilizing different cuts of the animal different times of year. I mean, this is a vocabulary that we really need to learn and a fluency for which we don't have, especially in the American diet. But it is absolutely more delicious. I mean, look, a steak while I love a steak and I will defend a steak to my death, I will also tell you, and I bet if I polled 20 random chefs in succession, they would all answer the same way, which is that while a steak is delicious, you don't want to eat it every day or even more than once a week. And that, and if you polled those 20 chefs or another 20 chefs, you would get a similar answer to the question of, if you had the choice of a cut of meat, what would you rather eat, oxtail, which is where I made that marmalade from, what would you rather eat a steak? And 20 out of 20 would say the oxtail because there's so much more flavor.
Yeah.
So, you know, we need to get away from this. I mean, a steak is heating a piece of protein. It's putting a piece of meat on the stove and getting it to heat through. And that's really actually not cooking. And while there's a lot of flavor in good steak, there's a hell of a lot more in other cuts of meat, especially if you add some culinary creativity to it. And so that's what we need to do. I would just like to add, because before I sound arrogant and a little haughty about my great parsnip steak concoction here, and I am really proud of it, if that doesn't come through. But at the same time, to humble myself, I will just say that it's that what I've described, this turning the steak dinner on its head, this recognition of what the land can provide adequately and sustainably at a certain time of year, is really what all great cuisines of the world do. I mean, I'm not doing anything that peasant French food or Italian or Cantonese or any of the hundreds and thousands of cuisines and micro cuisines, you know, cuisines that break down everything that I just mentioned into real locality and region and you know, there's a different risotto in every town you go to in Italy. You know, the reasons for that are ecological as much as they are cultural, and they derive from ecology. They derive from different soil types. They derive from different landscapes. And so that's about listening to what the landscape, or in the case of the risotto, what kind of soil produces what kind of rice for what kind of risotto. And that's the kind of thing that we don't have that in our DNA, and we don't have a food culture like that, and we don't have a cuisine, really, is what it comes down to, and America never has. And so what I'm defining so proudly is really looking back at what every great culture has done since the beginning of time, which is create a pattern of eating around supporting and improving the landscape, because they had no other choice.
Yeah, okay. So, Dan, stay where you are, please, because this raises the question of, but this sounds a lot like farm to table. So what's the difference between what you're describing and that? And how would we begin to do something like this when you think about all the moving parts? So stay right where you are. Dan Barber, great, great chef and phenomenal author, it turns out. The Third Plate, his field notes on the future of food. We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton with Dan Barber on the future of the food we choose and eat as it could go to create a food system at its best, in his view. Barber, executive chef at Blue Hill at Stone Barns and Blue Hill in New York City, is author of a book on his vision called The Third Plate, and it is an extraordinary read. So, Dan, you were talking to a farmer, and he says to you, we need to grow nature. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, I think he meant by it, and it's, you know, it definitely confused me for a while, and I'm still working out the answer long after I've written the book. But I think the general meaning is that farmers need to farm in a way that keeps nature working as nature and not opposing nature. I mean, that would be opposing nature or fighting nature would be utilizing things like chemical interventions, like pesticides and fertilizers, which get you a result, you know, a larger harvest in most cases, or a more predictable harvest. But they end up fighting the very things that nature needs to end up producing well and producing delicious food into the future. So, you know, the thing that I took from that conversation and have wrestled with and continue to think about in my cooking is how can we eat in a way that grows nature? How can we encourage a certain diet that does that very thing, that improves nature? Because at the heart of it, you know, agriculture is a disturbance of natural beauty, of nature. But it can disturb elegantly, and it can disturb elegantly, and it can disturb thoughtfully. And that's what we need to do for the future if we want more delicious food. So an example of this, I mean, you mentioned a little earlier about how is this different from the farm to table? How is it different from you and I doing the right thing, getting up on a Saturday morning, going to the farmer's market, shaking the hand of a farmer that grew, tomatoes and a zucchini that were about to go into the season, buying a lot of, and going home and cooking with that. And you know, my answer to that is that that's a very good transaction and should be encouraged. The problem with it is that I don't think it ends up, and I think the last 10 years this movement has grown and there's been more farmers markets and more people doing those, that kind of transaction I just mentioned. It hasn't amounted to a heck of a lot of change in sort of the on-the-ground farming reality, because it ends up allowing us, you and me and everyone else who cares deeply about these issues, to cherry-pick ingredients. We treat the farmers market a little bit like we treat the supermarket. We choose those cuts of meat in many ways. We choose those vegetables or grains that we most covet. And things like tomatoes and zucchini and eggplant and most cuts of meat generally carry a big footprint. Even we're told to eat more vegetables, but things like tomatoes, you know, are the Hummers of the food world or the soil food world. I mean, they end up costing a tremendous amount of soil fertility and time and energy and real estate and labor. And so a winning movement isn't about allowing us to cream, skim the cream off of the farming landscape for just those things that we truly cherish. A winning diet for the future is one that puts the pieces together. And that's why I keep coming back to this idea of cuisine, because it amounts to a pattern of eating that really discourages us or doesn't allow us to indulge in our hedonistic impulses. And our hedonistic impulses usually drive to things like steaks and center cuts and tomatoes and corn and those things that taste delicious. In part, they taste delicious because they require a lot of soil fertility. And that ends up not working, I don't think, for the future unless you balance it. And then cuisine does a good job of that. Look, Japanese cuisine is known for rice. But to get rice to grow, you needed buckwheat as a rotation crop into rice. Buckwheat gives you the carbon, it breaks up disease cycles, and you couldn't have the rice without the buckwheat. Well, the Japanese didn't take the buckwheat like we do when we grow, you know, organic rice, organic wheat. We generally have farmers that rotate in buckwheat. Well, where does the buckwheat go? Usually to dog food or usually to bag feed for animals. We don't eat buckwheat in this country. But the Japanese, well, they didn't do that. They created, you know, soba noodles. And soba noodles became inculcated into the everyday food culture. So what does it mean to be Japanese from a food perspective is as much soba, as much eating your rotation crop buckwheat as it does to eat rice. And we don't have that tradition in this country because we were never forced into that kind of negotiation, except every cuisine was forced into a negotiation. Italians, they got their risotto rice, but they also have their leguminous crops, which is why Southern Italian cuisine is so infused with beans. And you had Parmigiano Reggiano with the whey from Parmigiano Reggiano fed the pigs, and you got, prosciutto di Parma. So those are putting the pieces together in ways that allow great and delicious flavors, but also where waste is and agriculture necessity becomes infused into the everyday food culture. We don't have that in the farm to table ethos, and we need to find it in this next iteration of farm to table.
You ask these questions in the book. Do you see the natural world as needing modification and improvement? or do you see it as something to be observed and interpreted? Do you view humans as a small part of an unbelievably complicated and fragile system, or do you view us as the commanders? The farmers in this book are observers. They listen. They don't exert control. Shakespeare and about one of his characters who's a blind man, and he has one of his characters say to the blind man, how do you see the world? And Shakespeare has the answer, I see it feelingly. Then you remark, the farmers in this book see their worlds feelingly. So nature, as we know, can be, you have that farm there, ruthless. So here is somebody who's trying to make a living, support a family, whose success or lack of success, existence depends on nature. And we see that nature can be ruthless. We see farmers who say, I'm not using antibiotics. And then just by chance, even though good practices, there's an infection that starts among all the chickens, and pretty soon a little bit of antibiotics have to be introduced. You know, how far do we take this, and how do we balance in that nature left to its own devices could overrun us in a second?
Yeah, well, nature will overrun these kind of agriculture systems that you're describing and many, many others always when there's no diversity or when there's less diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Because the hardships of farming that we always experience in the history, in the 10,000 years we've been domesticating animals and grains and vegetables, there's always hardships with each season in any place that you farm. But the hardships generally fall harder on those farms that lack diversity. And the problem with American agriculture, in large part, is that we don't encourage diversity. I come back to diversity. It's a very simple answer to your sort of very complex question, of course, but I don't mean to be simplistic. It's just that a lot of the problems with the hardships that befall American farmers and farmers around the world increasingly is that when bad conditions arise, no rainfall, too much rainfall, early frost, late frost, mm-hmm. You end up, if your tips are in one basket, if you are a tomato farmer only, or you are not diversified with your crops, you will be hit and hit very hard, and you don't have backup. And so the point of the third plate, I guess, and the ultimate point of third plate and of farming for the future is that we really need to encourage diversity, because when hardship comes, you know, when bad weather conditions arise, it generally is very bad for some crops, but it also can be good for others. And that's the lesson of agriculture. That's the lesson of good agriculture. And so, you know, the thing we can do, you and I can do, is just eat a lot more diversity. And so the call for the third plate is to continue to diversify, which is why great cuisines of the world are so diversified. There's so much in the way of different ingredients, because that was you were hedging your bets, and that's how we have to think about the future. Unfortunately, the last 50 years, especially 60 years, we've been able to develop technological applications, chemical applications that for the most part soften the blow of those difficult moments in farming. But it's a facade, and ultimately, the greatest protection against the inevitability of farming is diversity, because you suffer with one crop and you gain with another, and that's been the history of good agriculture, and that's what nature. When you dialing back to your quote from my introduction, is listening to nature is really about diversity, because nature, there are no monocultures in nature. It's about a diverse system, and in that way, it ensures continuation. Because nature always fights against any kind of monoculture.
I was thinking about the word diversification, and as you were talking, applying it to so many things in our lives across the entire system, it seems so important. I hear what you're saying, and you've got these profiles of all these farmers who care so much about what they're doing, and growing these remarkable things and doing it with such integrity that it makes you want to weep sometimes.
Yeah, right. I know. I felt that too. And I hope I didn't give the impression. I mean, I know that for sure about it throughout the entirety of all these characters is, you know, while all those farmers appreciated good food, their shiv, their drive in all this was not foodies. They were not hardwired for the best possible flavor, although that was of great interest to most of them. It was sort of a benefit of their great farming. And that's where I found like this really incredible serendipitous outcome, which is that when you really listen to nature, when you figure out what kind of diversity improves the ecological health of your soil and of your farm, then you always produce the best flavor. It's sort of axiomatic, and that's a very inspired and I think exciting conclusion for how we might look at the future of food.
I think you're saying that we're in this kind of closed loop, though, even though we've got this farm-to-table movement finally taking off, and we are, you know, in the past 25 years, America has been rediscovering its regional cooking.
Yeah.
I mean, so many great things have happened in that way. But I think you're saying we're in a closed loop because farmers are now caught in this bind where they're growing for our choices. And, you know, they're afraid to move outside that box because they know what it's like to plant something and nobody buys a cassava,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Exactly. And the margins on that kind of stuff are always so thin that you can't afford to be risk takers if you're farmers.
So where does it start, Dan? Well, you know, where does this begin? I know you haven't thought out the plan, but I'm just wondering, does it start with us as eaters, or does it have to start with the farmers? Where does this begin?
I don't think it starts with the farmers, and I'm not letting them off easily. I think that in fact, I think a lot of this starts with chefs, and I put a lot of the weight on chefs, not just because I am one, but because I see increasingly a culture that looks to restaurants and to chefs as icons and as broadcasters of messages. We seem to have this platform. Mm-hmm. It seems weird. It's weird to call myself a cultural icon, and I don't mean that.
No, no.
Other than we chefs have this kind of power and this microphone to which we can spread the message. And at restaurants, while we think of them as places of escape from our harried and very complicated world, we should also be thinking of them more and more as places of connection. And I think that's a great opportunity for restaurants. I think restaurants are doing much more of that. That you come to a fine dining meal. I'm not talking about fast food chain, and I'm not talking about middling restaurants that don't do much better than fast food restaurants. I'm really talking about devoting your dollars to a pleasurable evening eating and around the table with good company. And that kind of opportunity, I think, we shouldn't overlook as potentially shifting mm-hmm. how we think about food in the future. Look, the parsnip steak is a sort of cheap example. It's just one plate, and it's filled with a little bit of, you know, sort of wryness. It's taking this classic American steak dinner and turning it on its head. But think about if that were repeated and interpreted in every restaurant, high-end restaurant, in its own way, in its own region, mm-hmm. over the course of a year. And you end up seeing how quickly the food culture can change. It's one of the blessings about America is that, you know, our biggest Achilles heel is we have no food culture. We have no real cuisine that you can look to. I point in the book to Southern cuisine. But aside from that, there's very little in the way of a food culture that puts the pieces together like all the great cuisines of the world. We just don't have that. But what we do have without that tethering is we have freedom. And we tend to become obsessed with ingredients. Greek yogurt. Where did that come from? In 5 years, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. Uh-huh. Quinoa. I mean, you look at all these foods, sushi, 30 years ago, it was like eating insects today, and today it's become America has this opportunity because of this lack of food culture to engage in new ideas and new thinking and do it rapidly. I think some of these ideas, I know some of these ideas come from fine dining, and they will continue to. And I don't mean to sound like this is a movement that's top down, because you know that sounds very Republican. I don't mean it that way, but trickle down or whatever. But in some ways, the food culture, that's how it happens. It's not bottom up. It happens from chefs who create culture out of these ideas and, mm-hmm. and put these ideas into action on the plate. And that's where I think the farm-to-table movement is headed, and where if you look at fine dining just over the last 5 years, I mean really over the last 60 months, just what's happened to the expectation for fine dining is no longer lobster, caviar, and foie gras. Well, when I opened Blue Hill almost 10 years ago, you had to have that on the menu and charge a certain price, but that is no longer the case at all. In fact, what diners are looking for are great tasting vegetables and grains that are from seeds that represent a region from a long time ago, repatriating old food ways. That's become very interesting and provocative, and it gives people, especially who are traveling, a sense of place. And that to me is the ticket to the future of good eating. I think ultimately restaurants will rise to that challenge, and already are in ways that I envy with a lot of chefs. Mm-hmm. And ultimately that'll trickle down to the everyday food culture.
We're seeing, you're right, in New York City alone, which is close to our studios, we're seeing more and more restaurants opening that are vegetable centric and not, as you say, in the old sort of vegetarian way.
No.
That this is a whole other thing in a way, the same direction that you've been moving in for quite some time. This is Dan Barber. He's author of The Third Plate, probably the best work on food and its meaning that I have ever read. And I encourage you to have a look at this and join the conversation, 203-776-WNPR. Dan Barber will be right back with me shortly. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much to our producers, Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol. We are with Dan Barber, who is executive chef at Blue Hill in Manhattan and in the Hudson Valley, Blue Hill at Stone Barns, which is an agricultural center restaurant. Amazing farmland, gorgeous, gorgeous place, doing extraordinary cuisine in terms of what he's talking about, in terms of philosophy. You can try it all there. But let's take a call. Hi, Kate. Faith Middleton with Dan Barber. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks Hi. For taking my call.
Sure.
I had an idea. Your guest suggested that we eat outside of our normal ritual, and I think one of the best ways that I know of to do that is to join a CSA and support your local agricultural farm and get a lot of vegetables that you would not normally get at the grocery.
Well, so Dan, I think Kate is getting at something. When you have this CSA, and it's like being a member of a co-op, except the co-op is your farmer, it's interesting, and maybe is that a way of letting the farmer plant according to what the system you're talking about, and in a cooperative way with nature, and saying to all the CSA members, this is what we have right now.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I'm really glad Kate raised it. I should have myself, because it's a great answer to deepening the farm-to-table connection, is that you are not allowed to treat the farmer's market like the supermarket. And in fact, you are really forced to eat the diversity and cook with the diversity. And I think it's a fantastic example of what we should be doing more of.
Thank you, Kate. Really appreciate it.
If I could just add, there's also an opportunity to expand into, you know, lower socioeconomic strata, because SNAP benefits are also available for farm markets and for CSAs.
Yes, they are. Thank you so much. Glad you
called,
Kate. Thanks for raising that. So this What about cooks? This comes to this issue of let's say I belong to a CSA and the farmer says, okay, we're having these beet greens. This is what you're getting this week, and maybe one other thing that I don't have much experience cooking. How do I learn to make these things that seem a little bit exotic or unfamiliar to me delicious enough so that I and my family enjoy them? This is going to take quite a while for us to be fluent in this new language and in these.
Because it requires not only a food culture, it requires a cooking culture, and that is a whole different thing. It's one and the same, but it's very hard to see these ideas come to fruition if people aren't cooking. Because as we know, when someone else is cooking for you, especially when food is being processed, you end up not eating as well, but also eating with less diversity, because it's very hard to cook with diversity and create a business out of it if it's not a restaurant. So the home cook is key here. You asked before, how do these messages move forward? I think that while it may start in restaurants and then, bleed into the culture, it's got to be taken up by people who are willing and excited to spend the time to cook for their families and their friends. And there's never been a better time in the history of the world for sharing and getting access to information about cooking. I mean, the internet is just, it's open to every possibility for cooking anything. Mm-hmm. By video or by recipe, we forget that yesterday you're getting a recipe was just very difficult, and you pass them down through generations. But now the world has literally opened up to you, and the ultimate guidebook in how to prepare something is one click away. That's really a new universe.
So let me tug at you about some of this and see what happens. What do we, we live in this world where so many things are available to us, and we take advantage of those things. Sometimes it's just out of sheer convenience, and people are being driven mad by their schedules, and they just grab whatever they can. Other times, it's a thing where you say, I'm in the mood for asparagus, and that tastes good inside my mind, and I'm hungering for it with a little bit of goat cheese, and so I think I'm going to grab this asparagus over here. There are people like Joan Gusso who's gone around and lectured for a long time and said, you really shouldn't eat stuff from that's more than 50 miles from your house. And I think, well, if you lived in California, that would be a good assignment because there's such great stuff growing there. Their climate's different. Or in Italy. But if you're in the Northeast, this is kind of tough to have this. Why wouldn't I buy asparagus from I don't know where? Because I'm tired of broccoli rabe or beets.
Well, if you hang on for another 3 or 4 weeks, you have a lot of asparagus. assuming you can hang on.
That was a bad example.
We're serving the last of our pickled and fermented asparagus from last year. Mm. So it's perfect timing. We're running out of it, and this is a personal thing, but I do think if you're going to ask me about a prescription for pleasure, and when it comes to food, one of the great pleasures of eating is being denied certain foods for much of the year, and then being allowed to be hedonistic about them at certain times of the year. I really look forward to the asparagus because I haven't had a fresh asparagus since last July. I mean, that's there's really something that's very simple. It's something very deeply pleasurable about that. Sounds like I'm dictating how people should eat, but I'm really talking about how to take the most pleasure from your food. And you mentioned California, if there's places like California, but look at what's happening with California. I mean, look at what's happening with irrigation mm-hmm. to feed all that asparagus that you want at this time of year. I mean, that's those wells are running dry, and that's in part, I mean, this is a very again, simplistic way to, and it's not really fair because it says a little bit out of context, but one of the reasons that California is in such trouble with their irrigation and water problems is because you want those asparagus right now. I mean, that, you know, there is a huge market for things like asparagus, artichokes, and lettuces that are out of season, that we, as you say, what's wrong with demanding that? And if you can, you know, if you live in California, you could eat within 50 miles, but here, you know, we don't have that luxury, and so why don't we? If it's available to us, we'll look at what's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, California is entering a new world that will be very different. I mean, everyone who I've talked about it said, you know, the future of California agriculture, especially in the Central Valley, which is where a lot of our asparagus comes from, that will not be the same for our children. And in part, that's because the water tables have dialed down so much to feed vegetables and fruits to a world that demands asparagus or something else when it's not in season.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of my love of peonies. And part of that love is the surprise of them for a very short time. So
I'd say same idea.
Yeah, it's same thing. So I was in Paris leading a food tour for our listeners probably, 20 years ago.
Oh, and I was cooking there. I may have run into you.
Really? So yeah. I went to Rungis, the market outside of Paris at 4 o'clock in the morning where all the chefs go, and I come upon something. Now, 20 years ago, what I come upon is all those tents with all the stuff, and everybody's picking this, that, and the other thing. And then all of a sudden I noticed that there's this one tent off to the side. And in that tent, just outside of Paris, were all the jewels, you know, I mean, the jewel vegetables and jewel grains that had been set up like we were at the most extraordinary jewelers. And, you know, they were, everything was 3 inches long, and it was extraordinary to look at. And you saw some of the big name staffs in there picking these things for the high end temples of cuisine in Paris. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is just happens everywhere.
Right.
There's first class, tourist class, you know, business class, economy, even in the vegetable market. I mean, even in Paris, I mean, where I thought people were still closer to doing things the right way.
Yeah. I'm sorry. That was 20 years ago, huh?
Yeah. I don't know what's going on now, but at least they still are feeding their school children.
That's right.
Real meals, you know.
That's right. They're filling the future generations with a food ethic and a culture around. I mean, they've really invested in that, both culturally and economically, into making sure the next generation values food and agriculture in the same way.
We're talking about an article I think probably both of us saw, or maybe you witnessed this firsthand. I didn't. But in schools, children sit down at dining tables with napkins and cutlery and have real meals with courses. And the education system subsidizes this because of what Dan says, trying to get these kids to understand that this is part of their cultural tradition. What, Dan, you would call the culture part of the word agriculture.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And when we try and separate that, even those farmers and communities that have the best intentions with agriculture, if the culture isn't subscribing to it, if it isn't doing the kinds of things that you just talked about, passing on to its next generation, if it isn't thoroughly infused into the everyday mores and traditions, then it doesn't last. And that's our problem in large part with American agriculture. It's not that American agriculture is so bad. It's that food culture is so bad. And we tend to bemoan the big agribusiness, you know, entities of that rule the food landscape. But really those are offshoots or realities that are based on a lack of food culture. And we buy into that literally every day. And, you know, it's a very easy excuse to say that You know, we have corporations that are poisoning our land for future generations. The truth is our food choices, because as you mentioned at the beginning of this piece, is that really, you know, we can determine the kind of world we want to live in and the kind of agriculture system we want by choosing to support it with our diets.
Well, the parallel for me is smoking. I don't think people, when they took a first puff or two of a cigarette, said, that's delicious.
Yeah.
They liked the feeling it gave them, and then they were addicted. And so my problem might be more with the engineers, the food engineers, who are so brilliant at engineering our choices.
About as brilliant. I think you're making the analogy to that hit of tobacco that becomes, you know, difficult to refuse. But now look where we are with smoking and the rates that have plummeted for smoking in just the last 20 years, even less, 10 years, with some, you know, some cultural change. I mean, now mm-hmm. it's not considered fashionable to smoke at parties, in restaurants and bars. You're not allowed to, but also it's not fashionable. And the rates of smoking, long-term smoking, have declined dramatically in ways that if we had talked about this 20 years ago, you wouldn't have believed it. And that's the culture changing. So that too could happen with food, and I think more rapidly, in part because it's the pleasure principle. We're not talking about just giving up cigarettes with food, or we're talking about giving up, you know, fast food or giving up processed food, but in its place, we're talking about hedonism and enjoyment and pleasure in ways that are far outstripped the equivalent, you know, analogy to a hit of tobacco. And that's very important, I think, for the future. Why I think this movement is just in the beginning, because we are very good Americans at figuring out how to pay more for and subscribing to pleasure, and that's what we're talking about here. So I feel very confident about the future.
The grandmothers in so many cultures had it down, didn't they? Because nature, they took what nature gave them, and they did, based on how much money they had, they did the best with it that they could.
Yeah.
And then all these years later, the next generation and the ones after that still long for those tastes that those grandmothers produced.
That's right.
And so they were delicious.
Yeah. Well, they were. And you know, I think some of the best cooking always develops out of scraping by, out of a little bit of work that requires you to think creatively. You know, the best cooking doesn't actually come out of abundance. And that's why all these, you know, cuisines that we celebrate today that have lasted thousands of years are so important, because they all developed out of real hardship, and of just eking out just what the land could produce, and then figuring out how to make that, you know, delicious and nutritious for your community. That was difficult maneuvering, and in the same way that you know, we think of grandmothers cooking leftovers and creating something delicious and memorable out of them. And well, you know, that's part of the challenge, is we need to think in that kind of thrifty and engaging way to produce better food for the future.
Dan, thank you so much for being on the show. I appreciate it very, very much. I love this book, and I certainly have enjoyed my meal at your restaurant out there in the Hudson Valley.
Thank you so much, and thank you for taking the time to explore these issues.
Thank you.
Come back to the restaurant.
Okay, I will. Thanks. Bye, Dan.
Thank you.
Bye. Dan Barber, author of The Third Plate, his field notes on the future of food. It is quite eloquent, like a work of literature, actually. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, great recipes, value wines, easy cocktails online right now at the Faith Middleton Show, WNPR.org. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.